The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. I dipped into the archive for a couple of interviews this week. The first one was recorded in 2000 with Helen Fielding. She had originally been writing a newspaper column in England, which turned into a book called Bridget Jones' Diary. It became a bestseller, and she followed that up with a book called Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. It came out 19 years ago, and Helen Fielding came out to see me one day in Yellow Springs to talk about it. Let's listen now to the Best of the Book Nook with Helen Fielding. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WISO. Today, it's my pleasure to have on the program Helen Fielding, the creator of Bridget Jones's Diary and the sequel, Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're not from America, are you?
No, I'm English. You picked that up quickly.
Now, I understand that you used to be a reporter.
That's right. I first of all worked for the BBC on a bewildering range of programs, ranging from one program for two-year-olds to news programs for 10-year-olds to documentaries in Africa. And then I was a journalist in various national newspapers in London.
How did you get the idea for the diary?
Well, my first novel, Cause Célèbre, was set in a refugee camp in the Sudan. And I was working on a second novel, which was an earnest satire about cultural divides in the Caribbean. And I was really short of cash. And the newspaper asked me to write a column as myself, because London is full of people writing columns about their lives. And I didn't want to, because I thought it was very exposing and embarrassing. But I said, I'll make up this comic character, very exaggerated character. And of course, all that happened was that everyone thought she was me anyway, which was worse. But it was actually the germ of the idea came from a sitcom I was trying to write, which was about the girl with, it's the old banana skin joke, the girl with big ideas who says, well, everything's going to be marvellous and I'm going to lose a stone and cook dinner for 12 people. And then it all goes wrong. Or she says, I'm not going to sleep with him. And then cut to the next scene, her in bed with him. So that was the character.
But you're definitely not Bridget Jones. I know people have claimed that you are, but there's no way, is there?
No, I don't drink or smoke and I'm a virgin. And please don't laugh. That's very rude.
I can tell you've used that line before. My guest is Helen Fielding. Bridget Jones' Diary has been a tremendous success for you. Were you surprised?
Yeah, I was surprised, and so was everyone else. In fact, I got a certificate on my wall from Smith's, which is a big book retailer at home, saying, congratulations on making us all look really bad at predicting sales. It started quite slowly with the column and then the hardback, but it was with the paperback in the UK that it really went to number one, and then it stayed there for 6 months. And now it's sold in 33 different countries, which is extraordinary.
So who is Bridget Jones? I know we've probably got some people out there, mostly men, who don't know who Bridget Jones is.
Mm-hmm.
Who is she?
Well, she's a 30-something singleton, which is a word I coined to replace the old-fashioned word spinster. I really dislike that word. I think it has all these connotations of shelves and spinning wheels and tragic Miss Havisham figures who are going to end up dying alone and being found 3 weeks later half-eaten by a dog. She's besieged by lascivious uncles who keep asking her, how's your love life and why aren't you married yet? And she's a sort of archetypal singleton living in a city. And her world is made up of singleton friends, smug married friends. They're the people that when you ring them up, the conversation is punctuated with, in the potty, do it in the potty. Well, do it in daddy's hand then. And then she has her gay friends. So in a way, I suppose I was trying to write something to make myself laugh when I started writing it. I wasn't thinking that anyone else particularly was going to read it. I assumed the newspaper would sack me after 6 weeks for being too superficial. But I guess I was also looking at what I saw around me and trying to create a generic singleton and see how life works. So that's who she is.
And her world is populated by the characters you've mentioned. Also, she has two very close women friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's her mother.
Yes, the mother.
Mm. Her mother's an amazing woman.
She is. She is. The mother, the character for the mother came to me. There was a story in the British newspapers about this woman called Lady Graham Moon. And when she was in her 50s and her four kids had grown up, her husband went off with a younger woman. And she, rather than lying down and weeping about it, took his vintage claret collection and distributed it around the village as if it were milk. So I went to interview her. I thought this was very funny. But she was sad and lonely and said that she felt like the grasshopper who'd sang all summer. And now it was the autumn of her life and her children had left, her husband had left, and she was at the bottom of the pile. So I didn't run that interview. I thought it was really sad. Cut to 3 months later, I opened the newspaper. There is Lady Graham Moon sitting on a sofa in leggings and a stripy T-shirt. And she's got a new boyfriend and a new job in television. And I thought that was fantastic. And I thought it was very good to have an older woman who was empowered and in control of her life. And the thing about Bridget's mother is that Bridget is very confused. She's a real product of the media explosion. So she's prey to all these influences and she doesn't know whether she should be a Buddhist or a millionaire or a wife or a businesswoman or what. Whereas Bridget's mother has grown up in the same little town, lived there all her life. Her values are very solid and clear. And she has self-confidence. So whatever she does, whether it's running off with a Portuguese tour operator or bringing a Kikuyu tribesman home from Kenya to the Rotary Club, she is absolutely sure that she's doing the right thing. And if Bridget criticises, she says, "Oh, don't be silly, darling, it's fine."
Bridget is a modern woman, and all these swirling influences on her are typical of what women today in our culture are dealing with. And one big influence on Bridget and her friends are all these self-help and self-awareness books.
That's right. At one point, Bridget remarks, "Surely it cannot be that reading self-help books to improve my relationship has destroyed the relationship." My first book was based on Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. This one's based on Jane Austen's Persuasion. And what's doing the persuading in Bridget's life is, to a large extent, self-help books. There's a lot about dating in the second book. And Bridget observes that it's almost become as if men and women are on opposing sides of an army, firing shots at each other through the darkness. And that in dating, it's as if there's all these rules that you're supposed to be keeping. But the trouble is you don't know what the rules are because everyone's got a different set of rules. And it's Bridget's mother in the end who remarks that it's all nonsense. There's no such thing as sell-by dates for women. We're not pots of cheese on a shelf in a supermarket. And you just have to be a real person and be yourself and let the other person be like that too. Because the trouble with Bridget is she thinks if she has a relationship, it's not going to be with a real man. It's going to be with Brad Pitt loading the dishwasher naked and feeding her ice cream.
Helen Fielding has joined us. The Venusians and the Martians.
Mm-hmm.
This has been an influential book, and apparently it's had its effect on Bridget.
Oh, yes. Bridget remarks at one point that self-help books are almost like a new religion. And it's as if people don't have an organized religion anymore, they make their own. And I think it's no coincidence that the top 10 nonfiction books in America were once self-help books quite recently. And I think Bridget and a lot of people need some sort of guidance about how they're supposed to live. And that's why she turns to these books. And in the end, she rejects books like Mars and Venus on a Date and What Men Want and What Men Think They Want or What Men Feel They Might Think They Want and If the Buddha Dated Muhammad, all that she junks. But she does think some books are worth keeping and that they have some basic principles that stand her in good stead, like being optimistic, not holding on to resentment, having confidence in yourself, the sort of things that her mother would tell her.
I must say, having read both books, that I was very pleased. I think there's a vacuum in the humor genre here in our country and in English-speaking countries. I don't know about other countries, but there are so many books that come out, and so few of them are funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading your books, and I kept laughing. And I've got to say, in the new book, the books are very different to me. In the new book, as you kept building the story, I found myself hysterically laughing two or three times on each page. I couldn't believe it. I'm so glad to have a little humor.
Oh, that's so great to hear. I like things to be funny. I think people are funny. Most of my friends are very funny. I think women, when they get together, are very funny. And it's a good way of looking at things, I think, rather than... You could write a serious political tome about the state of womanhood now. And sometimes when my book is analysed, I feel as though I have written a serious political tome, but I didn't mean to. It was meant to be a joke. In fact, one reviewer in Italy called the first book a transcendental study of existential despair. But I think something had gone wrong in the translation. And another in, I think it was Catalonia, they called it the diarrhea of Bridget Jones. But, you know, it was like Spanish, il diarrhea.
Uh-huh.
But still, it made me laugh every time I heard it. So that's why I called it The Edge of Reason, because I thought it sounded existential and Sartre-esque. But nevertheless, I think it's easier, certainly easier for me to communicate what you observe through humour than through some weighty tome that would bore me even as I was writing it.
When you wrote the first book, did you have any plans to write a sequel?
No, I really so didn't. Well, I didn't have any plans for anything, really. I just started doing this column, and then we started getting letters praising it. And I hadn't admitted that it was me. But then I'm so shallow, as soon as we got fan letters, I suddenly said, it's me, it's by me everywhere. And then I was supposed to be doing this book I mentioned about the cultural divides in the Caribbean, but frankly it was so boring that I couldn't even write it, let alone expect anyone to read it. So the publisher said, well, why don't you do Bridget's book? And I said, oh, okay. And it was as casual as that. I handed it in late as usual. And... It was only people started to filter through that they liked it. And then the hardback sold okay. But I hadn't imagined that anyone was going to read it at all in the first place. I thought it would be just buried in the middle of a newspaper. And I think that freed me up to write. The best advice I ever had about writing was write as if you're writing a letter to a friend. So that's what I was doing. Nobody was going to read it. I hadn't even told my best friend I'd written it. So I was really just writing to make myself laugh in a private way. And I think that frees you up to be much more honest about the thoughts that people have than you would if you thought A Breathless Nation was hanging on your every word. So that was what was hard about writing a sequel.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2000 interview with Helen Fielding, talking about her character Bridget Jones, and the Best of the Book Nook will continue right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And this morning, I'm bringing you the Best of the Book Nook, and at the moment, we're listening to Helen Fielding. She came all the way to Yellow Springs from her native England to talk about her character, Bridget Jones. The book was Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. We have one more segment in this interview and then a special Book Nook bonus for you coming up in our final segment with Andrea Dworkin. Here's Helen Fielding. You really created the form for yourself in the diary. and then you decided to write the second book, and you're using the same form, but you've obviously thought a lot about it, and you've changed it just a little bit. The way she starts each day in the first book, it's very formulaic in that she keeps track of how many cigarettes she smoked, how many drinks she had, how much she weighs, how many lottery tickets she bought, how many times she thought about calling someone. In the second book, you have a little fun with that. And the second book is maybe a little bit more profane. Do you think?
Rude?
Not rude. I mean, there are certain words that she didn't use quite as much in the first book that she uses a little bit more in the second book.
Could you say some of those words? Or perhaps not on the radio.
I think she says shagging and snogging a lot, I think, in the first book, but words of that genre. Yeah.
Well, do you know, I hadn't realized that at all. I was listening to an author talking the other day, and he said, you only find out what your book is about after you've written it, because everyone tells you. No, I wasn't conscious of that.
Okay.
It could have been because I was so very late for my deadline that thoughts were filtering through.
Well, I read the first book, The Diary, and I just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to talk to an author about two books that are related and say, you know, I think this book is better than the other book, because the authors, they don't want to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, after I read the first book, how could she top this? I read the second book, and I absolutely loved it too.
That's fantastic, because I was just feeling crestfallen then and thought, he's going to say that he didn't like the second one.
I loved it. And you have some scenes in that book that are so funny in the new book. The first book too, but the new book, they're fresh in my mind because I just finished it. The scene where you have Jeremy reading the poetry, that is so funny.
Oh, that's where there's the book club, and Bridget's gay friend Tom brings his lover, pretentious Jerome, to read to the lovely middle-class ladies of Grafton Underwood, who sit there in appalled dismay as he reads ruder and ruder bits out.
Another.
I must admit, that's rather happened to me during readings, though. I once did a reading I shan't say which town in America, but it was a bit rude. And I suddenly realised as I started that it was all wrong and everyone was appalled and dismayed. And it was like going over Niagara Falls in a barrel, you know, I was stuck with it and I couldn't stop. So
you picked a portion of the book that maybe wasn't appropriate?
It was a bit racy, shall we say.
Okay. Yeah. The books are Bridget Jones's Diary and Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. Helen Fielding, the author, has joined us. If you haven't discovered these books, you don't have to be a woman to like them. I'm a man, and I read them, and I thought they were hilarious. You've had a lot of men read these books, and they're not just for women, are they?
No. I get quite a lot of letters from men. In fact, one of my favourites was in the early days. It came to the editor of The Independent, rather a formal letter, and it said, "Dear sir, I would quite like to shag Bridget Jones. Could you let me have her phone number, please? Many thanks. Yours faithfully." But I got a letter recently from a 75-year-old man, and he said, "I've been trying to understand women all my life, and I've just read Bridget Jones, and now I think I do." And that was an awesome responsibility for me. I worried about it. But then I thought, when he's got to 75, you know, it can't do any harm.
You mention a couple of names in the book of English people who are pretty well known, who have actually sat right in that chair, and I had to chuckle when I read the name Joanna Trollope.
Really?
She sat right there. Terry Waite has sat right there where you
sit. Really?
Uh-huh. Mm. Now, why didn't they like Terry after he got out of being a hostage? What was that?
Well, I have no idea, because I wasn't there. But
you mentioned it in the book, though. It made me curious.
It was just a feeling you picked up from the from the news coverage.
That's
afterwards.
Okay. I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
No.
But I want to ask you one question. I'm dying to know. Did you have to get your blouse wet again after the water scene? You have to read the book. The book is Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. That is another hysterical part of the book.
But you know, that was a real interview. This was an interview between Bridget and Colin Firth, the actor who played Mr. Darcy in the BBC's Pride and Prejudice, with whom Bridget is obsessed. And they sent me out to interview Colin Firth in Rome. So I pretended to be Bridget and he pretended to be Mr. Darcy. And the interview is more or less a transcript of that.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Does your publisher notice that as you travel around the country on book tour that the sales just get better and better?
I hope so. I always fear that I might harm the book and it might slither down the charts the more I talk. But let's hope that isn't the case.
Now, what's it like when you go to a book signing? Do you have a lot of people clutching dog-eared copies of the first book?
Yeah, I love book signings, actually, because it's actually pretty boring being a writer. You spend a lot of hours and hours just sitting in a room with a computer. So it's really good to read it. I love hearing people laugh. And then they all come up and you sign the books and have a little chat with everyone. And, yeah, a lot of people bring English copies that they'd had a long time before it came out here, copies that have been passed around amongst people, which, of course, makes the publisher tut-tut, because everyone should buy their own. But it's nice for me. And, yeah, they bring English editions of the new one. And some people even have my first book, Course Celeb, which makes me proud.
Wow.
So it's fun.
So when you're out there meeting the public, do you still read from the book, or have you stopped doing that?
No, I read from the book.
Do you?
Yeah, read from the new book. Try a different bit sometimes. Sometimes read the same bit. And then do questions and answers. I like doing that because there's out. So people sometimes ask about that and how it all started and all the different countries, you know, how they react to it in different places.
So what about the movie?
Well, it's I think it's going to start filming in May or something like that.
I understand they've already cast Bridget.
Yes, they didn't ask me. I mean, they didn't ask me to be Bridget.
Who's going to play Bridget?
Renee Zellweger, that was in Jerry Maguire.
Uh-huh.
She'll have to do an English accent, though, because it's all going to be set in London. And I don't know about the rest of the cast yet. I think they're working on that at the moment.
I love it when Bridget is in her cups and you're trying to understand what she's saying in the diary.
It's a very good fan, very good fan.
and Tom is a wonderful character. Tom is her gay friend.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really a member of the inner circle. He's really the only man who is in her inner circle.
Yeah,
he's very unique. He gives her a viewpoint of men that she really desperately desires to know.
Mm. Though he's not perhaps the best person to choose. But Tom has a theory that single girls in their 30s and gay guys have got a lot in common because, as he said, they're both being used to being treated like freaks by society and disappointments to their parents. So I think there's the bonding thing. And actually, there's quite a lot of gay guys like the books. I get a lot of gay guys at readings and things. Because I think there is the same thing of being in a slightly pioneering social position and really trying hard to get things right. I think that's a thing singletons and gay people have in common, of really, you know, trying to make a good life and do things right and so on, and keep getting irritated by other people that haven't quite caught up with how you're living, you know.
I'm guessing that writing this book and the success that it's engendered has probably had a tremendous impact on your life and your whole existence. How so?
I've turned into a monster, obviously. Well, it's made me very busy, and it's meant that I've had to get a lot more organized, because I wasn't the most organized person before, and I'm still not the most organized person. But you've got to get a bit organized to go on a book tour, for example. You can't keep leaving things everywhere. And though I have had a lot of suitcase trouble. I mean, last year on the tour, my suitcase got jammed shut just as I was leaving for the reading with half my suit in it. And we had to ring at the head office of the suitcase company in Texas to get it open. And then this tour started with me picking up the wrong suitcase from the baggage carousel in New York, which was disastrous when I had to be on the TV first thing the next morning. And that makes it sound as though I haven't improved, but actually I have. I'm much more organised now, I think. And it's great, actually. It's fantastic. I've been trying to write for years and years and years. And to have so many people buy your book and like your book is just, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. Never mind about suitcases.
Well, you're very funny and you're very clever. And in the new book, you even get into the thriller genre a little bit.
Ooh.
Because we worry about Bridget. We think that maybe things aren't going to be very good for Bridget for a while, and we won't tell readers why, but she gets herself into a terrible mess.
She does. Yeah, I wanted to try and do something a bit different. And just, it's nice for a writer to try and slightly move things out of what you normally do. So for, I think it's just one chapter or two chapters, I take her away from London, and that is quite a adventurous bit. So it's good that you like that bit.
Well, you had me guessing. The only thing that I guessed was the bullet. I did guess the bullet.
Did you?
But that was just because I knew you were using sleight of hand there.
Mm-hmm.
I had a clue. I felt wonderful that I guessed it. But then you take it somewhere completely wild.
Yeah. You didn't guess who'd sent it.
I did guess who
sent
it.
Oh, you did guess.
It. Yes.
Right.
But I never guessed what would happen with that particular individual.
Mm-hmm.
The book is Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. And its predecessor, Bridget Jones's Diary, is available now in a paperback.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for coming out and seeing us.
It's been a pleasure.
That was Helen Fielding, recorded 19 years ago, talking about Bridget Jones, The Edge of Reason. Don't go away. I get all kinds of guests on the program, and we're going to go from a somewhat lighthearted interview to a much more serious one coming up in our final segment. My interview with Andrea Dworkin, recorded back in 2002 for Heartbreak, the political memoir of a feminist militant, right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. In 2002, I did an interview with Andrea Dworkin for her book Heartbreak, the political memoir of a feminist militant. She died a few years after we recorded this interview, and it turned out to be the final book that came out during her lifetime. Let's listen now to Andrea Dworkin on The Best of the Book Nook.
My guest is Andrea Dworkin. Her book is Heartbreak, the political memoir of a feminist militant, and she joins us by telephone on the program today. When I got to page 13 and I saw the heading, The Pedophilic Teacher, I thought, here we go. You had three teachers in school that you remember pretty well. You call them brilliant teachers. They're all very different, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Yes. Two of them were political conservatives, which now it sort of shocks me to look back on. And one of them, the one that I call the pedophilic teacher, he really liked little girls, and he used us, my two friends and myself, as kind of sexual toys. And that was shocking to realize, because when you're a child, you don't realize that. You don't understand what it is or why somebody is doing this to you or treating you this way.
And yet there was something attractive about him, something that was ineffable in a way.
Well, what was wonderful about him was that he was willing to teach us the things we wanted to know. We wanted to know about jazz. He was willing to teach us about jazz. We wanted to know about Paris. He had been to Paris. We wanted to know about Sartre. He knew about Sartre and, you know, would get us the books that we wanted to read. And he never clamped down on us or punished us because of what we wanted to know. So the problem was that he also, there was also a trade-off. And the trade-off was that we had to do for him what he wanted done as an adult male. And that wasn't fair.
You discovered books, and This was transformative for you. It always has been, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, books are kind of life and death to me. They're blood. They're the one way out. You know, when you're bored to death and your teachers won't teach you anything and you want to learn and they still won't teach you and you're kind of begging them to teach you something. And books are the only place you can find it. And so I was enamored of books very early on and thought that books were just kind of like if you could get on a plane and go anywhere in the world that you wanted to go. That's what books were like for me.
And near your home, you had one of the early shopping malls, which seemed like a vacant, empty space until they put a bookstore in there, and suddenly Andrea was hanging out there all the time.
Yes, that's right. I was in the shopping mall. If you wanted to find me, that was where you had to look. And it was a small bookstore, but it was a brilliant bookstore. And they had all the poetry from City Lights books in San Francisco, and they had Edward Albee, and they had James Baldwin, and, you know, all of these writers that I would hear about, but that I didn't really know anything about until I read them myself.
And City Lights was the imprint for a lot of poets, including Allen Ginsberg.
Right,
And you talk about Allen Ginsberg. You met him. You were crazy about him at first, and then you discovered some things about him that you didn't like.
Yeah, I adored him. I thought he was a great poet, and I thought he was kind of the like the master of the universe. And I wrote to him when I was in high school. And he wrote back to me, which was just a totally thrilling event. And I met him when I was in college, and he asked me to come visit him, which just stunned me beyond what I could believe. And I did go visit him, and we spent many hours talking. And then I didn't really stay in touch with him. Because I thought that he would have too much influence on me, really, as the writer that I wanted to be. But two friends had a child, and they made him the godfather and me the godmother. So we had this kind of metaphysical marriage, I guess you could say. And I didn't see Alan again until our godson's bar mitzvah. And at that time, he was determined to let me know that he was a pedophile. And there were lots of 12-year-old boys at this particular bar mitzvah, and he would point to them and he would say, you know, and I want that one, and I want that one, and I want that one, and I want that one. Hmm. And I was miserable because I knew that he meant it. And in my world, which has had a lot to do with sexual abuse, you don't use boys like that. And so I became, in a way, very antagonistic toward him.
He disgusted you, and you became virulent opponents and enemies. You wanted him to die.
Well, what I said was, I mean, it was ironic. That Saturday of the bar mitzvah, the Supreme Court had just come out with a ruling that child pornography would be illegal in this country. And I was very thrilled with the ruling. And I knew Alan would be, you know, very angry about it. So I did my best to ignore him and to stay away from him because I felt that the best thing I could do for my godson was, you know, not to have any kind of conflict of any sort. And yet Alan sort of pursued me everywhere I went to talk about this, and he wouldn't leave me alone. And he really talk about it, and he wanted to talk about why I didn't like pedophilia and why I had been, you know, was so antagonistic to sexual abuse. And he did tell me during that period of time that he thought that all sex was good, even forced sex.
Hmm.
And, yeah, that disgusted me.
Hmm. My guest is Andrea Dworkin. The book is Heartbreak, the Political Memoir of a Feminist Militant, and it was just published. She joins us by telephone on the program today, and it's on the Basic Books imprint if you're looking for it. Andrea, you and I came up in a time when people had fallout shelters in their backyards. We were asked to go get underneath the desk. We were worried about a nuclear holocaust. These were different times. They sensitized us quite a bit, didn't they?
Yes. I mean, we grew up and were told that when a certain bell went off, we had to climb underneath our desks and cover our ears with our hands or our elbows, and that was somehow going to save us from nuclear war. I never understood it. And when I went to high school, I still didn't understand it. In high school, they made us stand up against the walls and cover our ears. And I thought it was ridiculous, and I thought that it was very odd that teachers didn't do it. You know, if it was so important that we do it, why weren't they doing it?
Hmm.
And it was the first time I really thought that adults as a group were liars, that they just lied to children all the time.
Andrea, about a year ago, I had a guest on the program who had just written her memoir called The Virgin of Bennington.
Oh, Kathy Norris.
Kathy was here, and
yeah.
And she mentions you in her book. You both went to Bennington, and it's intriguing to me to see the different perspectives. She has that perspective of being so innocent and being in this den of iniquity and really not understanding what's going on. Your view is from a very different perspective. This sounds like a very bizarre college at the time.
Well, in a way it was, I guess. Kathleen came from a very sheltered home, and I didn't. I mean, I sort of ran away off and on from the time I was a young teenager, and I started prostituting when I was a fairly young teenager. So when Kathleen and I met at Bennington, we were like these two opposites, but we liked each other very much, and we're friends to this day.
Eventually, Andrea, you ended up in Amsterdam, and you married a man from Holland, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, and he was a batterer.
Yes, he was.
And how did you get into this? Did you see the warning signs? Did you have any clue that this was the way it was going to be?
No, I really didn't. I liked him because he was reckless, and he wasn't afraid of anything, whereas I was afraid of many things. And I didn't know a lot of the things that he knew. I mean, he had a very interesting political mind, and all that to one side. Again, I was living in a culture that I didn't know and didn't understand. And so I was trying very hard to learn the new language and be part of a new world.
Ultimately, you escaped from Amsterdam and ended up on the Lower East Side of New York. And I'm guessing this is where you became an activist.
Well, in a way, I think I had been an activist from the time that I was in the sixth grade of refusing to sing Silent Night,
mm-hmm.
and also refusing to stand up against the wall when we had our various bomb scares. I mean, I just wouldn't do it. I thought it was ridiculous, and I wouldn't do it. And my father was called into school and basically said, you know, what do you expect me to do? There's not a thing I can do about it,
mm-hmm.
about what she will and won't do. And certainly when I was in Amsterdam, I was an activist. And when I was in Holland, I was an activist. And when I was in Crete, I was so admiring of the people there because it was just a time when the United States had funded a coup in Crete, and the CIA had funded a coup, and Papandreou became who had been elected leader. Was then deposed from his elected office, largely by the United States. And people would come from all over. They came from the mountains. They came in wagons that were led by mules. I mean, they came 3 days and 4 days and 5 days down from the mountains. And I admired that tremendously. I mean, just the fact that these people had so much gumption and so much conviction about what they believed in.
Did that happen when Nixon was president?
You know, I don't remember.
I think I seem to remember it did. There's so much in this book. It's Heartbreak, the political memoir of a feminist militant. Andrea Dworkin wrote it. She joins us on the telephone in the Book Nook today. And I'm going to skip forward here because I can see that we're gobbling up time, and I don't want to miss some of this that I really wanted to talk to you about. You have a section called Capitalist Pig, and in a way, it's a joke, isn't it?
Yeah. The capitalist pig in the chapter is me.
Uh-huh.
As I became a feminist speaker and I started asking money for my lectures and started trying to learn how to earn a living that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a letter one day from a woman who told me I was a capitalist pig. So
you talk about running into Abby Hoffman's, was it his wife, Anita?
Yes, okay. Anita was his wife.
He had just, I think, been locked up for cocaine or something.
Selling cocaine, I think.
You gave her some advice.
Yeah. She was very much alone, and she had very little money, and she had a child to take care of, their child together, whose name was America. And one of Abby's friends wanted to prostitute her, and she was confused about it, about whether she should do this or not. And I talked to her about that at some great length and told her that she would. She said to me that she liked sex, so it would be a good thing to do. And I said, if you like sex, it's the worst thing in the world that you can do. Because there's nothing more more loathsome to somebody who likes sex than prostituting.
Mm-hmm.
You lose all your taste for sex and all your love for the man in your life, and you become very much somebody who doesn't want to touch other people.
It's you describe it as in a way it creates a profound disconnection with yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, you just can't do it and remain a whole person.
I think this is a natural segue into your work with Catherine McKinnon.
Yes, well, Catherine McKinnon and I worked together for many years, and we worked on prostitution as well as on pornography. I think many people don't know that, but the work on prostitution was something that just followed naturally from working on pornography. And we had written a civil law that would allow women who had been either forced into pornography or forced to use pornography to be able to sue the people who had hurt them. And that was something that we thought was not only conscionable under the First Amendment, but something that we thought was an important civil rights step for women, that women not be degraded by pornography.
My guest is Andrea Dworkin. Andrea, I think if the book had just been distilled down to the section titled Immoral, that it would be well worth reading. Obviously, there's so much more here, but I think that the section Immoral, you are really saying what you believe, and so much of this is so powerful. You say, the worst immorality is in imitating those who give nothing. You've thought very hard about these, haven't you?
Yes. Yes, I mean, when you reach a certain age, you really have to decide what stand you're going to take and how you're going to take it. And I've always been fascinated with what doctors are supposed to do with the Hippocratic Oath and do no harm. Mm-hmm. And it's always fascinated me. So I tried myself to think about what are the things that the rest of us are supposed to do. And from my background in dealing with prostitution and my background in dealing with women who don't have very much, I decided to try very hard to work that out.
And it's not just doing no harm and being passive, it's doing something and doing no harm,
which is very hard.
Well, Andrea, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. It's been so nice talking to you.
You've been listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and that was my 2002 interview with Andrea Dworkin for her book, Heartbreak, the Political Memoir of a Feminist Militant. Andrea Dworkin died at the age of 58. That was 14 years ago. She had a very difficult life, and her life shaped her outlook on life and her philosophy. And if you go into Google News and enter her name, Andrea Dworkin, you'll find all kinds of recent articles about her. If there's one word that comes to mind when I think about Andrea, it's the word controversy. She was a controversial figure during her life, and she still is. And even among feminists, there were tremendous gaps between people who agreed with her and people who disagreed with her. She pushed a lot of people's buttons, and she really was an amazing person, and I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with her, even though we were talking about some very painful subjects, like her husband, her Dutch husband, who abused her, who battered her. There were some segments of the interview that I took out because of space. We just didn't have enough time to run them. But her experiences in a jail in New York City were transformative for her. And she ended up getting that horrible place closed down. Andrea Dworkin suffered a lot, and she thought a lot, and she was passionate about her beliefs. And I'm glad I was able to record that interview with her. You've been listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO today with Helen Fielding and
the late Andrea Dworkin.